Welcome to the Hanover Messianic Ministries audio presentation of the devotional study series entitled The First Regathering, Modern Israel. In this portion of our study, Hanover Messianic Ministries director, Pastor Bob Morris, will continue tracing important events in the history of the modern state of Israel. Pastor Bob will continue the class by discussing significant events that occurred in the first 7 months of the year 2002. Following the teaching session, you'll be given information explaining how to contact Hanover Messianic Ministries with your questions and to order additional resources. Now, let's begin lesson number 18. Here's Pastor Bob Morris.
Let's begin lesson 18 of our study in modern Israel, the first regathering, modern Israel. We begin with the year 2002. Again, a very, very tumultuous year in the history of the modern state. Let's start in January of 2002 with the Karen A Palestinian freighter captured. In January, Israeli commandos seized the PA-owned freighter Karen A, capturing 50 tons of weapons destined for the PA. The ship is owned by the PA and commanded by a PA naval officer. The weapons were valued at $15 million, and they included long-range missiles, mortars, mines, and advanced explosives. Now, the PA is not permitted to have these weapons under the peace accords that they have signed with Israel. The captain of the ship, Omar Akawi, admitted that the arms were headed for the Palestinian Authority. He was told to deliver the arms off the coast of Gaza. Secretary of State Colin Powell, U.S. Secretary of State, called Yasser Arafat and demanded an urgent and full explanation. U.S. Vice President Cheney stated that it was clear that Arafat or people very close to him were involved in the arms smuggling attempt. But caught red-handed, even though they were caught red-handed, the PA denied any involvement. Yasser Arafat's own words 1 month later, in February of 2002, were these, quote, "We have no connection with the weapons ship. It's all a trick. It's all a PR trick by the Israeli Mossad, the Secret Service. In the storehouse, I have enough weapons, much more than was on that ship." So a very defiant Arafat responds that he knows nothing about it. Israel continues to confine Arafat to his Ramallah headquarters in January. Israel imposed a travel ban upon Yasser Arafat until he arrests the killers of Israel Cabinet Minister Rahavam Zavi. The first hints of the U.S. severing ties with Arafat surfaced with the disclosure that the Bush administration was considering sanctions against the PA. Arafat ordered the arrest of the PFLP leader Ahmad Sadat in connection with the killing of cabinet member Zvi. The PFLP had claimed responsibility for Zvi's assassination. Now, the PFLP reacted with the threat to kill a Palestinian security chief unless their new leader, was released. They claimed that Arafat had buckled in to Israeli and American dictates. On January 20th, 2002, Israel experienced the first woman suicide bomber. 28-year-old Palestinian medic Wafa Idris was the first woman to ever carry out a suicide mission. Her mother called her a martyr and a hero. And when she was not religious, she did not pray, and so this was quite a surprise, because some Islamic fundamentalists say that it is forbidden for a woman to commit suicide for any reason, but Wafa Idris was not religious. That was probably the reason why she did it. Apparently she did it for social reasons only. Well, the attack sent new security standards for Israel. Now every Palestinian man and woman, every Palestinian child, is a potential suspect. Now, while Islamic theology promises extravagant rewards for male martyrs, it is not so clear what promises are made to women suicide bombers. Merit, the Jewish publication Merit, on June 5th, 2002, reported that the two female suicide bombers that had occurred in Israel to date, one of them, of course, being Wafa Idris, they both were divorced, shunned by their families, and felt that their lives were over anyway. They were recruited, apparently, as a way of bringing honor to themselves after disgracing their families. Let's move on to February. February 3rd, 2002. The northern border grows warmer. The Israeli foreign press asserted that Iran had supplied Hezbollah militants in Lebanon with 8,000 missiles that could hit Israeli cities. He warned Lebanon that Israel would not tolerate missile attacks from Lebanese territory. And so the fear that that Hezbollah would begin attacks in the northern sector of Israel's border are becoming more and more viable. February 7, 2002, Qassam 2 missiles seized and launched. The IDF seized 8 Qassam 2 missiles on a truck traveling from Nablus to Jenin. The missiles have a range of 6 or 7 miles and are capable of hitting Israel's densely populated coastline. If they were used, it would be a dramatic escalation in the violence, and these missiles were seized in the West Bank. On February 10, 2002, Palestinians launched Qassam 2 missiles on Israel. This was the first such launch of rockets against Israeli targets. The rockets landed on Kibbutz Sa'ad and Moshav Shuvah without causing injury or damage. Subsequent operations by the IDF were taken to prevent Qassam 2s from hitting Israel. On February 17, 2002, two more upgraded Qassam 2s landed in Kfar Aza, again without injury. On February 14, 2002, it became very clear that ambulances and medical vehicles were being used by terrorists. The terrorists were making more and more use of these vehicles. They are working on the premise that these vehicles do not undergo thorough examinations when passing through IDF checkpoints. For example, the first woman bomber, Wafa Idris, apparently was transported in this manner using a Red Crescent ambulance. She was a medical secretary for the Palestinian Red Crescent. Ambulance drivers, because they have relatively easy movement around the West Bank, have served as messengers for Hamas. And accordingly, Israel tightened up security checks on all medical vehicles. On April 1, 2002, the next month, a month or so from now, a Red Crescent ambulance would be found carrying a bomb. The bomb was hidden underneath a gurney where a sick Palestinian child was lying. It was removed from the ambulance and detonated in the presence of representatives of the International Red Cross. The driver confessed that he had tried to smuggle the bomb in and that it was not the first time an ambulance had been used to transfer terrorists or bombs. Another example, at the end of June 2002, IDF soldiers will stop two Palestinian ambulances for a routine check, and they will find 27 people packed inside them. 10 of those men were suspected of involvement in shootings or bomb attacks. And the use of ambulances in this manner is a direct violation of the Geneva Convention. Another significant event occurred on February 14, 2002. Under pressure, Arafat drew a gun. Reports have circulated that PA Chairman Arafat lashed out against the head of PA Preventive Security, Yibril Rayoub. Rayoub was considered the second most powerful figure in the PA, commanding a force of 4,000 Palestinian plainclothesmen and uniformed agents. He was also seen as the likely successor to Arafat. Arafat is reported to have been reacting to reports that Rayoub's forces failed to resist a mob that overran the PA prison in Hebron, releasing 17 Islamic militants. Arafat had ordered the militants jailed at the request of the United States. Apparently, Arafat demanded to know why Rayoub's men had permitted the prisoner release. Rayoub became angry and blamed the incident on the absence of any clear policy from Arafat. You see, Rayoub is not willing to take risks. He's not willing to act unless the orders are clearly spelled out in writing and authorized by Arafat, and Arafat avoids documenting his instructions. Well, subsequent events are hazy. One report says that Arafat threw a screaming fit at Rayoub, accusing him of plotting to oust him, cursed him, threatened him, punched him, or slapped him across the face. Most say that Arafat pulled his pistol on the security chief and, shaking with rage, may have dropped it. The details are impossible to confirm. Some intelligence officials claim that the story was a fabrication intended for the benefit of the U.S. It was designed to prove Arafat's dedication to curbing violence. However, if the report is substantially accurate, it indicates that there are serious cracks in the PA and that Arafat is losing his grip on control. In addition, the story indicates that Rayoub may be positioned to succeed Arafat. Rayub's dismissal in July of 2002 indicates that the event may have a factual basis. Move on to March 11. Israel lifts Arafat's detention. Yasser Arafat met a key Israeli demand after 3 months of defiant resistance. Palestinian police arrested all five terrorists wanted for the assassination of Israeli Cabinet Minister Rahavam Zvi. Arafat will be free to travel in PA areas, but will have to ask permission to travel abroad. Let's move on to March 13, 2002. The UN Security Council endorses a Palestinian state. The UN Security Council passed a resolution endorsing the creation of a Palestinian state for the first time and called for an immediate ceasefire. The United States introduced the resolution, which was approved by 14 of the 15 members. Syria abstained. The Palestinians welcomed the resolution. Israel stated that if a state was demilitarized, created through negotiations, and would live in peace with its neighbors, then Israel would accept it. Minister of Foreign Affairs Peres stated, and I quote, "Israel is a party to the desire to achieve an immediate ceasefire through the implementation of the Mitchell and Tenet plans, in order to pave the way toward a renewal of the peace process and a return to the negotiating table." And now we come to March 28, 2002, Passover 2002, for one of the defining moments in the history of Israel. A suicide bomber kills 22 in Netanya. A 25-year-old Palestinian terrorist, aligned with Hamas, walked into the dining room of the Park Hotel in Netanya, where 250 guests were beginning their Passover Seder, and detonated himself. He was disguised as a woman and slipped by the guards. The blast led to the deaths of 29 people and 140 injured. The attack became known as the Passover Massacre. The next day, Arafat announced that he was ready to work toward an immediate ceasefire. He said he was willing to unconditionally implement the Tenet Plan and the Mitchell Report, and then he went on to say, quote, "Unfortunately, there are some aggressive preparations by the Israelis to do a wide military operation against our civilians, targeting our people and our Palestinian authority." Notice how he's covering his bases, expecting Israel to react. Well, the next day, March 29, 2002, Israel did react by implementing Operation Protective Wall, also known as Operation Defensive Shield. On March 29, Prime Minister Sharon announced that extensive operational activity against Palestinian terrorism had commenced. Its goals, the goals of Operation Defensive Shield, or Protective Wall, were to crack down on terror, destroy terrorist infrastructure, confiscate weapons, and arrest fugitives. The operation extended from March 28, 2002 until April 19, 2002, just about a month. The IDF cornered a defiant Arafat in his Ramallah compound. They blasted their way inside and began a room-by-room search using small arms fire and stun grenades. The operation yielded documents that directly linked Arafat to Palestinian suicide bombings. Control of the entire compound was seized except for the floor of the building where Arafat lives. The army was instructed to isolate him, but not to take over his offices. Arafat used the opportunity to grant interviews with Arabic-language television stations. He stated that he wanted to become a martyr. During the operation, over 500 Palestinian men were detained for identification and questioning. Large stores of arms and weapons were discovered in Arafat's compound in Ramallah. These weapons were being held by the PA in direct violation of all agreements made with Israel. 10 terrorists on Israel's most wanted list were arrested during the operation in Ramallah. Now, the next week, Operation Protective Wall was widened. IDF made movements into Qalqilya, Nablus, Jenin, Tulkarm, and Bethlehem. During the entire operation, 4,258 Palestinians were detained, and 396 wanted suspects were arrested. Prime Minister Sharon addressed the nation, and he said, quote, "Israel is at war on terror. We must fight against this terrorism, fight with no compromise, pull up these wild plants by the roots, smash their infrastructure, because there is no compromise with terrorism. This terrorism is used, directed, and initiated by one man, Yasser Arafat." Arafat remained confined to his windowless office, with Israel supplying food, medicine, and water to Arafat and the people confined with him. Foreign Minister Shimon Peres stated that Israel had to achieve the goals that Arafat was supposed to accomplish. Palestinian leaders said that Operation Protective Wall was simply a pretext to kill Arafat. PA leaders even claimed that the IDF was planning to storm Arafat's headquarters in an attempt to snatch the wanted men and possibly send Arafat into exile. U.S. Envoy Anthony Zinni met with Arafat in his Ramallah office. Arafat told Zinni that he supported the tenant plan. However, Arafat has agreed to the tenant plan time and time again, but has never implemented it. Arafat's pattern is to never make a major decision unless under extreme pressure. On April 14, 2002, Sharon announced that the IDF would not lift the siege on Arafat until he handed over three of the alleged killers of cabinet members V. After 34 days of confinement, the siege was lifted when Arafat agreed to a U.S. compromise for ending the confinement. Under the agreement, six terrorists, including the convicted killers of cabinet ministers V, will be jailed in Jericho under American and British supervision. Israel stated that the assassins are with Arafat in the compound. And that was true. After leaving his compound, Arafat toured the areas hit by Operation Defensive Shield. It's notable that Arafat avoided the Palestinian refugee camp in Jenin. During the operation, 48 terrorists died in Jenin, and some members of Islamic Jihad were angry with Arafat. They stated that he didn't do enough to defend him, and that they made sacrifices for the Palestinian cause, while the PA did not. 2 weeks after the terrorists were jailed in Jericho, the Palestinian High Court ordered the release of the leader of the PFLP. Israel was livid and promised to bring justice to him if he was released. Subsequently, the PA overruled the High Court and kept the PFLP commander behind bars because of, quote, Israeli threats. Now, Operation Protective Wall was one element providing the necessary pressure for change. On April 5th, Israeli forces killed the mastermind of the Passover massacre. The leader, Qais Oduwan, headed the military wing of Hamas in northern Samaria. On April 15, 2002, the IDF captured Marwan Barghouti, the Tanzim commander in the West Bank. He was considered another natural successor to Arafat. Israel holds him responsible for the Al-Aqsa Intifada and for attacks against Israelis. The IDF initially thought he was hiding in Arafat's Ramallah compound. But after seizing the compound, the Israelis discovered that he was on the run. Eventually, they tracked him down to a building close to Arafat's headquarters. The IDF surrounded the building, and Barghouti surrendered without a fight. Under interrogation, Barghouti admitted to IDF forces that he had directed terrorist attacks in which scores of Israelis were killed. He also revealed how he allocated the needed funds to the terror cells and purchased necessary weapons. The arrest of Barghouti and other top-level Fatah activists and hundreds of rank-and-file Fatah activists produced information directly linking Arafat and terrorism. Their statements were supported by a vast number of documents seized from the PA offices. For example, those requiring financial support needed to have their request authorized by Arafat himself. Also, the names of potential Tanzim activists were submitted to Barghouti, who took them to Arafat for approval. April 2, 2002, the Bethlehem Siege. On April 2, 2002, Israeli tanks and troops rolled into Bethlehem as part of Operation Protective Wall. In response, some 200 Palestinians, many of them armed, stormed into the famous Church of the Nativity. The Israeli army besieged them for 39 days. The standoff between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian militants at this well-known holy site captured the world's attention. Entering the compound of a holy place is an old practice of Palestinian militants, because they know that the IDF is under orders not to harm holy places. Places of worship are offered special protection in accordance with international law. This action by the terrorists is a direct violation, or was a direct violation, of the Geneva Conventions and its additional protocols. Israel demanded that the militants either surrender or be tried in an Israeli military court or be expelled from the country forever. The siege was prolonged as various European countries refused to accept the terrorists. They don't want them either. Can you blame them? They should understand what Israel is up against. Eventually, 13 militants were exiled to Cyprus and 26 sent to the Gaza Strip. The residents of Bethlehem were relieved, stating that these men had imposed a two-year reign of terror on the city that included rape, extortion, and execution. April 3rd, 2002, the Jenin refugee camp is invaded, and Israel is accused of a massacre. On April 3rd, 2002, Israeli tanks rolled into Jenin as part of Operation Defensive Shield. They encountered stiff resistance from this bastion of terrorism and this from this breeding ground for suicide bombers. Many of the militants were associated with Islamic Jihad. The IDF encountered booby traps, booby trap buildings and alleyways, even booby trapped bodies, corpses. A very typical situation the soldiers encountered would be to approach a three-story building. The door and the first floor would be blanketed with booby traps. On the second floor, the soldiers would find a couple of civilian families, around 12 people, who were effectively barricaded in by the booby traps. On the third floor would be around 5 terrorists who would be shooting down at the soldiers. The Palestinian media began producing allegations concerning IDF interference with the sick, the wounded, the dead. They talked about systematic destruction of houses and a massacre in Jenin. In contrast, the IDF continued its policy of providing humanitarian aid as well as food, water, and medicine to the civilians in the West Bank and Gaza. On April 12, 2002, the United States Secretary of State, Colin Powell, stated that Israel has a right to defend itself. We have responded to terrorism. We know that Israel has a right to respond to terrorism. And that statement comes directly out of the attack on September 11th, the attack on the U.S. On the seventh day of the operation, a platoon of Israeli soldiers from the 5th Brigade were ambushed in a plaza. Almost the entire platoon was wiped out during the two-hour fight, with 13 killed and 6 wounded. The ambush proved to the IDF that the militants holed up in the surrounding buildings could not be extracted except with a great loss of life. And from that moment on, they changed their tactics. Foot patrols and house-to-house searches were discontinued. Instead, armored bulldozers were brought in and used to crush any home believed to be the source of enemy fire. The incursion lasted until April 19, 2002, when Israeli forces completed their withdrawal from Jenin. President Bush praised Prime Minister Sharon for meeting the timetable for withdrawal that he had set. Arafat's lack of desire to halt terrorism was highlighted by the fact that the Israeli government had presented U.S. Peace Envoy Anthony Zinni with a list of 33 most wanted terrorists in December of 2001, 4 months earlier. The list was subsequently given by Zinni to the Palestinians, and these men were never arrested or detained. As a result, 5 of Israel's most wanted terrorists were arrested during Operation Defensive Shield, and 3 had been killed. Israel stated that about 70 Palestinians, mostly gunmen, had been killed in Jenin. On April 15, 2002, the initial Palestinian claim that Israel had perpetrated a massacre with hundreds killed, including many civilians. I should say, on April 15, 2002, the Palestinians made the claim that Israel had perpetrated a massacre with hundreds killed, including many civilians. On April 30th, 15 days later, the Palestinians had claimed that 3,000 had been killed. In order to substantiate those wild claims, the Palestinians began adding bodies to the mass grave that contained the bodies of 26 people killed during the incursion. The Palestinians removed the bodies from a local cemetery. The IDF also caught a staged burial on film. A drone filmed a group of Palestinians carrying a body on a stretcher, and that burial was being filmed by a Palestinian cameraman. The stretcher bearer stumbled and the body fell to the ground, only to get up and return to the stretcher. After this happened a second time, the so-called corpse, walked off in a huff. On May 1, 2002, an American human rights group, Physicians for Human Rights, released a report stating that the evidence did not point to a massacre. The death toll was finally determined to be 7 civilians and 48 terrorists, 55 Palestinians in all, not 3,000, while Israel suffered 29 dead and 127 wounded. Yasser Arafat and the PA, badly weakened from Operation Defensive Shield, came under pressure from the international community to reform. Moderate Arab states, such as Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia, began to see Arafat as the problem, not the solution, and began pressing for reform. Moderate states began to desert Arafat. Arafat also faced unprecedented domestic criticism. Operation Defensive Shield caused additional economic hardship for the Palestinian Arabs, and so dissatisfaction with Arafat became more and more visible. Early in July, a significant demonstration occurred. The demonstration involved approximately 10,000 Palestinians. 10,000. They demonstrated in Gaza, blaming the PA for the disastrous economic situation rather than Israel. And this is a big turnabout. Up to this point in the history of Israel, whenever the Arabs call for a boycott or a strike or some kind of economic disaster comes upon the Palestinians, Israel is blamed. It's all Israel's fault for forcing us to do this to you. But now, with this demonstration in Gaza, the PA is blamed for the disastrous economic situation, and so the people are finally seeing where the true problem lies. It lies in their own people, not on the lap of Israel. Now, at one point, about 4,000, almost half of these 10,000 marchers, about 4,000, began marching toward Arafat's offices, but they were stopped by the PA police. More and more, PA officials began talking about lost opportunities, talking about having a normal life, their people leading a normal life, and they would begin to talk about a desire to change direction. Fatah demanded that Arafat appoint a prime minister to handle the day-to-day affairs of state. They suggested that Arafat remain the symbol of the Palestinian cause, but that he would no longer be the only one calling the shots. Accordingly, on Nakba Day 2002, Arafat called for sweeping reforms in his government and for new elections. The new elections were scheduled for mid-January 2003. Arafat's government reforms were less than sweeping. Arafat trimmed his cabinet from 32 ministers to 21. So there's only a small change in the cabinet. But two significant changes did occur. Number one, Arafat stepped down as the interior minister. He appointed a new interior minister who will oversee Palestinian security forces, removing Yibril Rayoub from that position. A behind-the-scenes power struggle between Yibril Rayoub and Mohammed Dahlan, the Gaza security chief, appeared. A supporter of Rayoub's rival was beaten by five masked men outside his Ramallah house. Arafat's dismissal of Rayoub threw the PA into turmoil. Rayoub's 4,000 armed men, refused to accept Rayoub's replacement. In addition, Palestinian police chief Ghazi al-Yabaldi in Gaza has decided to run against Arafat in the January election. The fact that a senior Palestinian is willing to run against Arafat is another indicator that Arafat's hold on power is slipping. April 17, 2002, we come to Israel's 54th Independence Day. On Israel's 54th Independence Day, the current population is 6.5 million, eight times larger than in 1948. The Jewish population is 81%, 5.2 million. The Arab population is 19% of the country's population, 1.2 million people. 2.9 million, almost 3 million immigrants have come into Israel since 1948. And at this time, 2002, Israel accounts for 37% of the worldwide Jewish population. The United States is still the country with the largest Jewish population. In the United States, the Jewish population encompasses 40% of the worldwide Jewish community. But Israel is close behind at 37% of the worldwide Jewish population. On June 17, 2002, the 34th Zionist Congress met in Jerusalem. Now, as the 34th Zionist Congress gathered, a poll was released, a poll that indicated that the majority of the Palestinians favored the destruction of the State of Israel. 51% said that the result of the conflict between the two peoples should be the liberating of all historic Palestine, meaning all the area covered by the Balfour Declaration. 71% supported terrorist attacks against civilians, and 48% supported attacks inside Israel. Well, at this point, our time has run out, and we've come to an end of our lesson. We'll pick it up with our final lesson, as we will finish up the last few events of 2002. We will go to the middle of 2002, and then I'll close with a little bit of a theological wrap-up for our class.
Thank you, Pastor Bob. It's our aim at Hadavar Messianic Ministries to deepen your understanding of God's Word and to better equip you to share the Messiahship of Jesus with your Jewish friends, relatives, co-workers, and neighbors. To order additional tapes or for more information, you can contact Hadavar Messianic Ministries at hadavar@hadavar.org. That's hadavar@hadavar.org. Or write to Hadavar Messianic Ministries at 14804 Sand Canyon Avenue, Irvine, California, 92618. Or simply call us at 949-559-1701. Again, that number is 949-559-1701. Again, thanks for listening to this audio presentation of the First Regathering Modern Israel, brought to you by Hadavar Messianic Ministries.